There's no magnetism here. You put it on the side of it, it's gonna, it's gonna show the magnetism. It's gonna show that it's trying to stick into it. So in the middle of it, you have a black wall. There's no magnet there. And do it again.
I double worked last week. Sorry about that, Roy. I'm gonna say I'm out if I can't do that. WS to it.
Okay, I mean, like I said before, they give that as the alternate answer. I just find it somewhat technical, Colby. I mean, how would you be able to arrange for, you know, again, you're in this room, it has no other metal, it doesn't really, it's not a science lab, the thing, so it's not like there's a big cork and a big tray of water and you can float it on there and see where it rotates. It's kind of stretching the answer, I guess, but the easiest one is simply to poke one bar in there and see if it shows any magnetic force and be able to tell the difference. So I'm glad everyone figured that one out rather quickly. I got one other word for today. Just like the last week I had the Google Blitz, this week I have the Schwinger Limit. Let me drop it.
Wait, what's the answer, Roy? I didn't hear the answer, WS Twin.
Okay, the answer was, John had the answer, Dick had the answer. If your hook, say you put one of the metal rods down, and that metal rod is the magnet, now you take the non-magnetized piece of iron, and you stick it to the middle of the thing on the table, you won't feel a magnetic force, because it's in the middle of the magnet where the magnetic lines and flux are the least, so for all intents and purposes, there's no real magnetic field. Now, if you reverse that and you put the non-magnetic iron on the table and took the magnet itself and touched it to the of the non-magnet on the table, you would get a magnetic force because the magnet that you're holding would develop a magnetic force on any part of that unmagnetized iron. So that's the trick, that you have to poke it in the middle, and the way it behaves tells you whether you're onto a magnet or a non-magnetized piece of bar iron.
This is what I said just last time, when I said about black wall, you put it in the middle, and there is no magnetism here, it's a black wall.
Thank you, Roy. I didn't hear the answer before. Very good, very well done.
By the way, you could do the compass experiment with a simple piece of thread suspended from the center with a piece of thread, and I think it was pretty fast to find out which one acts like a compass. One further complication you can add to the original question. Let me drop. There are ways of setting up coils on the outside of the room so that there is zero magnetic field inside the room caused by the Earth's magnetic field. You can cancel Earth's magnetic field inside of a room. If that's the environment in which you've got these two rods and you're asked to do the experiment, now you've had one more degree of restriction, if you know what I mean, Roy. Go ahead.
I mean, you could make it more and more complicated. I mean, just, Wes, I know you had the right answer, John had the right answer, Dick had the right answer, everyone had the right answer, so don't worry about it. But, I mean, there's all kinds of complications. I just like the clean and simple one that you and John and Wes gave. Because the other one, I guess you could do that with a string, but how effective would that be? I mean, it sort of depends upon how strong the bar magnet is. And, the conditions in that little room and where you are and all kinds of things. I just like the elegance of the answer more. Anyway, every so often people bring up the subject of how high can a gamma ray be. You know, is there anything such as too high a frequency where you can't have a gamma ray that frequency? And one of the things that comes to mind when you look stuff like that up is something called the Schwinger limit. The Schwinger limit is a theoretical limit where electromagnetic waves stop working in a linear fashion. Up until then, they work quite like you expect them to. And we talk back and forth, me and Wes, about how photons don't interact with each other, and they don't at normal frequencies. But if you bring it past the Swinger limit, it's the amount of energy required to create pairs of electrons and positrons. And you have nonlinear results, and you actually have collision of light waves where you can cause them to spontaneously decay into particle-antiparticle pairs. So that's called the Swinger limit, and that's one of the limitations of bringing up a gamma ray frequency beyond a certain point.
Do you know the number for that? Is it 10 to the 34 hertz, or is it a wavelength of 10 to the minus 34 meters? Is there a way of putting a limit where the Swinger limit is? Put a number on the Swinger limit, Roy, go ahead.
10 to 19 hertz.
Okay, I mean, usually it's represented as the voltage potential. But yeah, Wesley's right up. Oh, and it doesn't mean it ceases to. It simply means that it behaves in a nonlinear, unpredictable manner, and things just get stranger as you go beyond that point.
When neutron stars come together, you get these, I think it's one of the places where you might get a gamma ray burst. I mean, here Mother Nature is making a huge amount of energy at some extremely high temperature. Could that come close to the frequency region you talked about here, Roy?
I would assume so. I see no reason why not. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, it goes along with, what's creating these antiparticles that seem showering us at regular intervals. I think there's a lot of nonlinear photon decay going on.
It probably is happening once in a while, because whenever you put a gamma ray detector in space and you wait long enough, once in a while, an event will come along that saturates your detector. Would you like to realize that?
And the beauty of science is we really don't have a clue what's doing a lot of that. All those incredibly high energy gamma rays that we've detected radically, it really has a good idea of what's causing them. There's still things out there that are unexplained as yet.
The Swinger limit, how do you spell that?
S-C-H-W-I-N-G-E.
I presume that's a man's name?
Yes, that's the man who actually wrote up the equation on a theoretical basis for as the point of energy that was required to make electron-positron pairs. So they gave the term to him.
Roughly what year do you think you did that, Roy?
I believe that was around the 1930s.
Was this around the time when they're detecting neutrons and but the electrons had already been detected, so maybe that's the time when they're first detecting neutrons and maybe some of the evidence for quarks was coming along?
It was roughly around the same time as the neutrons. You have to understand, obviously, that it was the year for science to figure out the charged particles. But neutrons took them a little bit of time since they're neutral. But quarks came far after that. I mean, after they knew about neutrons and then they realized that there's a magnetic dipole moment in neutrons, they knew there was something in there, but they really didn't know much of what it might be until 40 years later or something. I mean, the thermodynamics is relatively young. The whole concept of red, green, and blue quarks and magenta, cyan, and yellow anti-quarks is a very interesting metaphor for how quarks work. Well, is it low? I don't want Paul to miss out on the space report, so I think we should move to him, but I would just like to repeat to everyone out there that the email address is mailbag@limartech.net. Any science questions, any business questions, any questions. And please come up with things that might interest you, and I'll look them up and talk about them.
You can say a little bit more about the Meissner effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's 11:10 Westwood. I mean, Paul prepares his SpaceNet report. If you want, I'll do a little addendum next week on the Meissner effect.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You made my day.
Paul? This crazy guy, Elon Musk, wants to put some thousand satellites. He's got permission to do this for this network he wants to create, which allows the 30-some-odd% population of the United States that has no internet connection to going to be getting internet connection with that technique. Boy, that's a lot of stuff that's going to be put into orbit. Unfortunately, he has the resources to do that. WS2N, space report number 288, KTRIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, that should be coming up, February 17th was the original date. I think it's a day or so away for that first test of those two satellites. That's not the primary mission, though. Primary mission is the PAS satellite. PAS is the SAR, Synthetic Aperture Radar Flight for Spain. The first one's in Spain. They built this satellite that's going to be used for looking at fine resolution of the Earth as it goes around in almost polar orbit and roughly around 300 miles up. The name of the mission is called PAS, P-A-Z, which is Peace for Spain. Translation of that. But on board, he's going to launch it from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California from a Falcon 9 rocket. After the primary mission is released, he's got two other satellites on board that he's going to launch to a higher orbit up to, going to be over 1,000 kilometers, so, 600-700 miles up, and he's going to run some tests. And like you said earlier, the FCC has approved these tests, and if all goes well, the FCC is also approving these future launches. 4,500 satellites, that's the goal. And he doesn't need all of them up there to get it into operation. But, if he wants to cover the area, not only just in the United States, like you said, Dick, but the world. He wants to get an extra 3 billion people on the internet. That can't be at this time, all these countries in the middle of nowhere that have no way of connecting to the internet will have antennas or gateway antennas in the local town pointing up and picking up the signals from these 600-mile altitude internet satellites that plans on manufacturing like cars. He's going to manufacture in California. He's setting up a factory. It's going to be located down the assembly line for the satellite. He has some competition. There's another group called Net1. They'd like to do the same thing, but I think there are only about 1,000 satellites or so. But then, you know, if he gets his up there first, that's fine. The other Net1 will probably do the same thing eventually, because Net1's it as well. So they'll just have competition, which is always good. So I'm looking forward to that launch. It's off okay. It's being launched on a booster that's been launched before. Again, it's a reused booster. They can't really use these boosters more than 2 times until the next iteration of the Falcon 9 comes out, which is going to be this year. Called the Block 5 model. Block 5 model will be able to do 10 launches and then still refurbish 10 more and so on and so forth, all the way up to 100 different launches. The ones that he launches now are, you know, the third and fourth generation of the Falcon 9, and they're good for one repeat. And that's the case with this one, and it's going to go into the Pacific Ocean, and that's going to be it for that.
Is he only allowed to use the price because of some kind of erosion, like in the nozzle of the engine that upholds it?
Yeah, as of now, he takes them back to McGregor, Texas, and West Texas, and cleans them up, and nothing to do with the engines. The Merlin, the engines are in good shape, but some of the plumbing and piping, he has to redo, and the outside of this Falcon 9 is not thermal. Thermal temperature that you go through, you know, during launch and re-entry is kind of high, and improved on that. And the new Falcon 9 will have better protection on the outside. It's also going to have a heat shield between the top of the 9 engine and the rest of the booster to protect the wiring, the controls, the sensors. Pipe itself. So this way, things can get eventually work it down to a day or two. Instead of right now, it's usually about a couple of months. Reckon now is 3 months to refurbish one. Drop. So now, instead of, I guess, bringing this thing back to shore, which he has the capability of knowing, he's just going to let it go into the ocean. But he's going to get to the point with the new boosters, once he builds, you know, pick a number, 10, 20 boosters, he won't have to build any more boosters, because he's going to keep reusing these things. And then he'll get to the point where he's going to be building his new rockets. You know, 5 years away, and they're the really big rockets, the ITS, the Planetary Transportation System rockets. So that's maybe five years from now, you might see the first launch of one of those after the Block 5 version. Block 5 version is also going to have better landing legs, and the landing legs will be able to retract. They'll be able to relaunch it in a couple of days. Right now, I think he just takes the landing legs off and puts it on. That's the story with Elon Musk. I hope he lives forever, because he's got these ideas. Unless he's got a crew that's giving him these ideas. I don't know. I think they're all coming out of his head. Come up with some outrageous ideas, and they come to pass. He wants a solar farm. Okay, he needs solar panels. Why do he need a solar farm? Well, he's building a launch complex in Texas, in Boca Chica, Texas, down right near the Mexican U.S. border, right near Brownsville, Texas. and the suspect film was complete, and you know, as far as the land and everything, spent about 3 or 4 years preparing the land. But just to run the power, there's really not an entity down there that's nearby that's going to supply the power for this launch complex. He wants to build a solar farm. So he's going to have thousands and thousands of solar panels, and that's going to create his power for his launch complex and the buildings and everything that's going to be needed down there. And doing that, he opened up another business called Solar City. And I see that truck riding around on the island. So right now they're putting in solar panels around the world. So that's one business. The other business is the electric cars. Tesla, in fact, this place right near me, we just bought these things to sell TVs, 6th Avenue, as you call it, and the large area, and he's going to sell cars out of it, 100 Tesla cars that he's selling and producing in California. Besides all these space things that he does, able to recycle the Dragon cargo vehicle that now goes up to the space station. He's done that a couple of times. You know, sent them up more than once. Landing drone ships, landing their boosters onto the drone ship. It's a 15-story thing. 12 feet of diameter. That's quite an accomplishment. And now, presently, he's building another drone ship. Now, he's got one on the Pacific coast, he's got one on the Atlantic coast. Now, he's building a second one for the Atlantic coast. But now, he's launching Falcon Heavy rockets. Sometimes, he's going to want to launch the rocket, very heavy payloads. And he might need to bring two boosters down the ocean instead of bringing them back to land. Once that capability, if not that, his manifest is getting so high where he's gonna one launch after the other. It takes a long time to land a booster on a drone ship. The drone ship is about 5 foot long, you know, maybe 200 to 400 miles out to sea. And it takes quite a few days to get this thing back to shore, and they have to have a crane and put it, you know, go through this whole process of getting moved all the way back. He could be launching another rocket, so in the meantime, so this other drone ship that he's going to bring out to this 400-mile area. And, after a book that he read. I'll find that I wrote it down here somewhere. But you know, one of the ships is Of Course I Still Love You. The other one is Just Read the Instructions, and now we've got a third one. Quite a character. Last week I watched Progress cargo vehicle go up to the International Space Station on a Soyuz rocket. It was supposed to go up about a week ago, but it had a 2-day delay. It's going to dock with the space station after launch from Kazakhstan in 3 hours. It would be a record. They tried this back in October. It didn't work out. It was kind of a malfunction. And there was a scrub at the launch, and they had to wait 2 days. The exact same thing happened this time. Last week, same setup. They were going to try to dock the space station in 3 hours. And there was a scrub, and that was it. So they waited 2 days, launched. And instead of getting there in 3 hours like they wanted it to, it took 2 days. day, the same thing back in October. The record is 6 hours, they've done it 6 hours. In fact, they did with the crew in 6 hours one time. They test these new systems on Progress cargo ship. Basically the same setup as the cruise vehicle launch. What happened last time and the time before will delay that process probably another 4 or 5 months. They'll try the same thing again. The problem is the space station has to be just almost right overhead when they launch. And the idea of the whole thing is eventually be able to launch a crew to the space station with only 3 hours instead of 6 hours or 2 days. If you've ever seen the Soyuz spacecraft on either side, it's quite cramped. They have an orbital module in front of them where they go open the door and they go through the hatch. They have a little bit more room in the orbital section, but it's still pretty cramped situation for 2 days. They're trying to get that down for 3 hours. It's possible. Just have to fix whatever glitch they're having. So that's the story on that. I wanted to talk a little bit about MRO. MRO is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has been orbiting Mars. 2006, and they were hoping to get 4 or 5 years out of it. Meanwhile, they've gotten a lot more years out of it than that. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has two jobs: defiance, spacecraft number one, or the high rise camera that looks right down to the ground. They can see very fine images. They've even seen the Mars rovers sliding around on Mars. They can see the tracks that have been left from the Mars rover. So, it does all the preliminary work for the Mars rover to look down and see where they're going. And also, mapping out the planet, doing all the stuff that the scientists like, all the geology work. One of the main jobs of MRO is a communication system, a repeater in the sky for anything that's on the ground. So it's worked successfully with the Spirit rover, which is not operating anymore. Opportunity, which is still operating, 2004. Spirit and Opportunity got there. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter wasn't even in orbit yet. They were using the older spacecraft that was still in orbit. So now the problem is this thing is getting older. They have gyroscopes on board, and they have momentum wheels moving around. They've got fuel on board, but they're trying to conserve momentum wheels and gyros, because eventually they wear out and years start to fly. So they've made plans on just using the star tracker to have cameras that look out from the spacecraft. They look at the stars and recognize the pattern of the stars. By doing that, the spacecraft knows exactly where the spirit is. They're switching over to that 100% of the time. And the only time that they will switch back is once they need to move it. If there's going to be a launch from Earth that's going to be coming to Mars 6 months later, they'll move the spacecraft into a certain situation where they can photograph it as it's going through the atmosphere. They've done that before. MRO has taken photographs of a parachute that's open as Curiosity or Phoenix landed when that went down. Have actual pictures of that, which gives them a good idea of what's going on when the visiting lot of Pacific spacecraft that are coming up there in the next couple of years. So rather than send this brand new spacecraft out, another couple of $1 billion, well, this one was $700 million, they would like to just keep this thing going. Drop it. So that's pretty much it for that. There was another Mars rover going up, Mars 2020. And that's very similar to Curiosity. That's the planet now, that's the one that's running on plutonium. That's the RCG, electricity, the solar panels. And we have a duplicate similar to that going up in 2020. And one of the things that they decided to do is these rovers, all these rovers, they have cameras on board, they have lasers on board, they zap rock 30 feet away. You know, with the lasers, and they were able to tell what it's made of. They need to calibrate these things the best they can. After they land, vibration or just time itself, expansion, contraction, or travel through space, sometimes their calibration might be a little off. They have calibration targets on the deck of the rover. And they decided, well, you know, what we need is a real good calibration piece. And they have Mars meteors that have landed on Earth. You know that from scientific experiments, they can tell that this thing really came from Mars. They plan on taking the piece, but I thought of these that they're going to use a very small piece. Maybe it's approximately $0.50. And they're going to take that and put it on the Mars rover. So it's actually the Mars that came here, you know, 50,000 years ago into our atmosphere from Mars. They're actually going to take the piece and send it back to Mars. And the idea is to shoot the air, cameras, and lasers, make sure that everything's on board perfectly calibrated. They've done it before with other things that they put in the target. If they use something that's actually from Mars, the calibration will just, you know, even a little bit better than what they can do now. So it's not like this is going to be different. They're doing it as a scientific practicality. And not much of time, so I know I'm going to run out of time. Just a couple of other topics. Wide field infrared survey telescope is something called the Southern First we've talked about here on the net. It's kind of going to replace Hubble. It's about the same size as Hubble. In fact, it's got the same size mirror as Hubble. When they made the mirrors for Hubble, they also made two more mirrors for the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office. They were going to take these big mirrors, make a telescope, put it in Earth orbit, and instead of looking at the stars, they were going to look down at, you know, different license plates. And they decided not to use these two mirrors decades ago for storage. And one day they got the bright idea to give one of them to NASA. So NASA is taking this thing. They're already working on it. And they're building another telescope, similar to Hubble, and it's going to have a different field of view. So as clear as Hubble, but able to cover 100 times more of the sky than what Hubble did. But because they're only getting a $19.9 billion budget, the administration has to cancel something. Now, this has been in the works for, I don't know how many years, to close up your first. And apparently this thing has been canceled. That's not good. The good news is they still haven't canceled the James Webb Space Telescope. They also want to cancel the part of the Discover mission. Discover mission was launched by SpaceX Falcon rocket some years ago, and it descended to the L1 position. That's the permanent location between the Earth and the Sun. So that's where that stays. So gravitational balancing there, it stays in that one location. We have other satellites in that location too. Soho for one, a couple of months, eight. So it's been doing great. Takes a reading of the sun, particles, things come towards the sun, drop it. This is WS1, and it knows that things are coming here. If there's a big corona burst on the sun, you know, we know that there's going to be particles coming in our direction. They know to turn certain satellites in certain different directions, maybe, you know, shut certain systems down. We know if it's going to affect our power grid. So, that's been operating. It still will operate after this budget is through. The only difference is one of the nice things on Discover is they have a camera that turns around and looks at Earth 100% of the time. And that distance is 1 million miles out. It sees the whole Earth. One section all the time, and that back to Earth, and we can tell the way the clouds are, the way the hurricanes are, from that distance. It gives you a good idea of what's going on. Also gives the scientists a good idea about, you know, global warming and all of that. The satellite was designed and was going to go up like the turn of the millennium, and they call the Triada. They named it Triada after the first guy that spotted America as he was coming across with Columbus. That was his name, and of course that they honored this guy. This thing was going to be looking at the Earth for a long time, and at the time, the big test project of Al Gore. Really wanted to try out as launch. Well, that election came and went, and as administrations change, one of the first things they did is let's cancel Triana. So they took Triana and they put it into a room. You know, NASA wrapped it up and put it in Baltimore. And it sat there for years until eventually administrations changed and it went up. Now that administrations are changed again, they decide, well, we'll keep the part that warns us about the sun, you know, and so the part that's looking back at the Earth, and what is it for? I mean, it's already there, it's 1 million miles out. But now, let's just get rid of it. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of this. Sometimes if the moon is going around, and it'll show you the moon and the Earth at the same time. It's pretty impressive. They're apparently going to get rid of Discover. Discover is another acronym, Deep Space Climate Observatory. Earth viewing instrument. So those two missions, one mission's up there, but part of it's going to be scrapped. And it's a cool part, I think. And then also something for another telescope, space telescope. That's an infrared telescope as well. Let me drop it.
Well, when a ordinary weather satellite that's in geosynchronous orbit comes up, it takes a picture of the Earth at 22,000 miles. The satellite you're not talking about at Lagrange Point number 1 is at millions miles away. Therefore, the picture it gets of Earth, granted to because of a greater distance, you see a greater percentage of the Earth, but the resolution of the portions of the Earth you're looking at from a million miles must be a hell of a lot lower than the resolution you get at 22,000 miles. So, what do they claim is the advantage of taking the picture of the Earth from L1?
Repeater, time out.
Over to the ball, K2LIW.
Well, the scientists get a good idea of the amount of light that's being reflected from the clouds. More light reflected from the clouds, the less, you know, less light than he's getting in the earth. That type of thing. Just by knowing that with super cameras and those sensors, they can tell what's going on, you know, from year to year. I come back 10 years from now, there's a different cloud cover or ice cover. These cameras are really, I mean, put in that word, put in CSCOVR, and then click on the image. Some of the pictures that they've been taking is incredible. Not to mention, it's a great scientific benefit for kids. The teacher can tell the kids in class, yeah, just bring this up. This is what we're looking at like right now. Well, it's just, you know, it's just maybe a half hour or an hour delay or whatever it is. But for all intents and purposes, it's almost like real time. And there's no other satellite that can do that right now. You know, once that 25,000 miles, you know, they're taking pictures of the Earth, you know, here and there, and that's it. And it's the same satellite is located in the same spot on Earth and going around and around. This is actually taking a series of pictures. You could actually see the Earth turning. Can't be that there.
Okay, I'm beginning to see that. So it's the whole darn Earth, as opposed to, it would take a very large number of geosynchronous satellites to take a picture of the whole Earth at once. One other question I've got, Paul, and that is the PAS, P-A-T-M, main thing. I've looked that up on a, let me drop it. And it looks to me like, one of the things it's proving is that a synthetic aperture radar made of a very large number of individual emitters is a large phased array with printed circuits and feeding circuitry, and it's got the scannability of 3/4 of 1 degree in azimuth and plus or minus 16 degrees in elevation. And you call it a very high resolution synthetic aperture radar. What is the main purpose of that? Communication and proving the concept, proving the technology, proof of concept, I accept that. Are they going to be using it for making precision measurements of Earth surface altitude, like being able to detect the change in sea level of, as we get thermal warming, as we get the global warming, or we call particularity?
Yeah, well, this is built by Spain. And they have 18 countries signed up with them, you know, to pay for this or actually work with them on it. So naturally that's fine, you know, back to all of those countries. They want it for multiple reasons, not only weather, trying to figure out the weather between whatever country we're talking about. And some of the military reasons. So it's going to be used for both. But what's interesting, if you look up synthetic aperture radar, another thing called SAR, on the internet. I'm not really that. You can't find. I can't find a picture taken with the SAR radar. Maybe after a while I might be able to find it. But what comes 10 West and all 20, one of your favorites. Group that IEEE, you know, 1F, and you have to be half. Some IEEE things, in this case, you have to read it, and you think you're going to go to some kind of tutorial, and all give you the first page, and after that, you got to sign up. So, but I thought I could find other sites or things to do with SAR. I can't. Go to a library to find something. Back to you there, WS20.
Synthetic aperture radar. In the case of doing it from an airplane, you take a snapshot of the Earth, and your synthetic aperture antenna might in the best case, extends between the nose and the tail of the fuselage of the airplane. You take another snapshot a few milliseconds later when the airplane has moved another 100 feet, and if you have enough phase coherency and you remember the first snapshot versus the second snapshot, you get the angular resolution of an airplane that's twice as long, if you know what I mean. And there's nothing stopping you from doing this four times in a row. You can create the equivalent of an antenna that's four times the length of the aircraft. And as you start doing more and more of this, you can end up with extremely high angular resolution of what you're looking at on the ground. Is that part of what they're trying to confirm? Proof of process here, Paul? With PAS, WS2N, KQRIW?
Oh, we've been doing it for quite a few years on our number shuttle board, went up back to the payload bay, and then we had them do the same thing by themselves. But this is the first shot for the Spain to do it. So that's what's new about it. We have two or three up there presently operating. Yep. It's the same system. What I don't get with the star is, all right, here's the thing, and it looks like a, sort of look at it satellite edgewise, it would look like a trapezoid, and it goes all the way back. It's a pretty long satellite. So everything is facing down, so the Earth transmits down, and the signal comes back up. But what I don't get, if it sends the pulses down, and it, up to 1,000 hertz or something like that, or in that category. But it'll send these pulses down. To me, that pulse is going to down. It's going to hit the ground, and it's going to come back up. It's going to hit the receiver. Now, a second later, I'm a couple miles downrange. I'm not going to receive that same pulse that's coming up. So, in my opinion, I'm only, whatever pulse you're sending, that's the one you're going to be getting back with that instant. So, I don't understand. It's not like you're sending one pulse down. You're going to receive that same pulse in, two or three different locations. So, I know it works. You're winding up with the equivalent of a very long radar dish. But science behind how that works. That's what I was looking for. The IEEE and the
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If the antenna array is being built on the bottom of the airplane and the nose to the tail, and the whole bottom of the airplane is filled up with the antenna array, and the airplane is like another 100 feet long, and then you've got a second airplane where the nose to the tail is 200 feet long, filled up with an antenna array. Obviously, the pulses you transmit and pulses you receive from the 200-foot-long airplane are going to have higher angular resolution in the direction that you're flying. Let me call that the elevation direction. You're going to have higher resolution. Okay. If you have enough phase coherency between all the pulses that you're transmitting, when you do that transmission with the 200-foot airplane, doing it all at once. If you do it with a 100-foot airplane, and you do it with two separate snapshots, and if you properly process the data, you get the same resolution as if the airplane was 200 feet long. The second pulse, when the 100-foot airplane has moved another 100 feet forward, is identical to the pulse you would have transmitted from the 200-foot-long airplane, if you know what I mean. So if there is enough phase coherency, pulse to pulse, if you really got a very accurate local oscillator and the right kind of synthetic aperture post-processing, you get the full resolution of the 200-foot airplane by taking two snapshots with a 100-foot airplane. I know that's a little hard to accept. You'll have to take my word for that one, Paul. Let me drop it. Airborne Instruments Laboratory did a lot of work on synthetic aperture radars that were put on airplanes, side-looking radars, with extremely high resolution. I didn't work directly on that project, but I was in the department alongside of my department. I was talking to those people from time to time as to what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I came to the conclusion it really does work. So two separate events, properly timed, gives you the same resolution as one great big antenna. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a ball.
Yeah, that sounds great. And if I worked there and they were looking for volunteers, I would have my hands up. Pick me. That sounds good. The difference with the 200-foot plane, yep, and this is, you know, when you transmit down and you're in orbit, in relationship to that ground, 1 second later, you are 5 miles downrange. 5 miles. So you're saying that this is almost like the equivalent of a 5 mile, in 1 second anyway, of a 5 mile leaving dish.
That's exactly right, Paul. The 5 mile receiving dish. Even though the transmission 5 miles downrange is a little bit different angle on transmit, you can crank that angle back out of the way you've illuminated the ground with mathematical processing. So I think you've accepted the fact that what you receive at first and what you receive 5 miles downrange, you can put that all together. So the two separate events, you can make it 1 5-mile long antenna on reception. But the way you illuminate the ground and the way the phase angles and the angular, the way the illumination of the ground takes place in the two events 5 miles apart, you can mathematically crank that back out as if it was one great big antenna 5 miles long. That's the way synthetic aperture is capable of doing it if you have enough coherency on the transmitter and the receiver processing. Over to you, Paul. K2RIW.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I'm going to still search the internet. I'd like to see the pictures that this thing develops. I mean, you know, it's not going to be photographic quality, but it's, you know, from what I'm reading, it's supposed to be 256. I think it was 10 centimeter resolution, something, 4 inches. Something of that nature. That's amazing. Pictures would probably, you know, look like round earth and mountains.
Yeah, let me give you some words on that. When you and I take a picture on clear sky from an airplane with optical equipment, you get very high resolution. When you do it with radio equipment that's running at a frequency half a million times lower in frequency, to the same size a lens, so to speak, you'd be getting half a million times less resolution. Well, the so-called lens you use on the radio is a million times bigger. It's a whole lot bigger than the glass optical lens. And when you do the synthetic aperture radar type stuff, even though you're doing it at, this thing's going to operate at 9.6 gigahertz, it's an X-band frequency, even though you're doing it half a million times lower in frequency. Because of the way you're synthesizing, let me drop it. In your example, you're synthesizing an antenna that's 5 miles long instead of a lens that's 8 inches in diameter, so to speak. You do get a radio photograph of that Earth. I've seen these things. It looks photographic. It has almost the resolution of a photograph. Even though you did it at nighttime through a cloud on a cloudy day, the radio signal penetrates all of that. You get near photographic resolution, Paul. They're amazing to look at. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, now you can understand why they, you know, part of this is military. You know, they don't care what time of day and night it is. They don't care if the clouds are out, they're going through it. And you know, when you say that the pictures are that good, wow, that's those 18 countries are going to be happy about that. I was looking for a list of 18 countries. I couldn't figure out if we wanted it or not, but we should be. We're launching this thing. Well, actually, we're not. SpaceX. So when you watch this launch from Vandenberg, you won't get to see it on the NASA site. You have to go to the SpaceX website or webcast and see what. There you go. One other. Telescope mission that's coming up is in April. The earliest would be mid-April, maybe May. It's the test mission. So we'll talk about that further down the log as that time comes closer. But that's very similar to Kepler type of deal that's going to be looking for planets or stars. Forward to that launch, also being launched by SpaceX. That's a very interesting launch. And that's not him. Back to Dick WS1.
And you're saying that if you work in the department alongside of the department that's doing this synthetic aperture radar, you would be volunteering. And I almost tried to do that. The next thing they get called beyond SAR. Called ISAR, Inverse Synthetic Aperture Radar. You can do a circular path. Let's assume that there's an object on the ground you're really interested in, and you fly your airplane in a circle around that object while doing this synthetic aperture radar thing and gathering all that data and properly processing it. You get a three-dimensional picture of that object on the ground. Could, in theory, make a hologram out of that data. Over to you, Paul, T2LIW.
Yeah, wow. That would have been a real learning experience. Any of those jobs, but anything. I mean, that's really out there. Now, they talk about using this eventually for planetary missions. Magellan. Was a mission to Venus, and that was a radar mapping thing. You know, no cameras whatsoever, all radar. And it mapped the whole surface of Venus. I'm going to try to figure out. I don't think it was a SAR mission, but you know, in the future it would be. But it definitely mapped the whole planet, you know, which was just radar, but I don't think it was one of those. I don't think that technology has developed that much when Magellan was launched.
Elon Musk's two experimental satellites for his Skylink were supposed to be launched originally on February 17th, which is yesterday. I think he said it got delayed about a week or so. Have any idea what caused that delay? And this launch, I think this launch takes place at Vandenberg, so it's not something we can see. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, that's Vandenberg. So yeah, we won't see. You won't see that from NASA. You have to get on the SpaceX website. SpaceX has it. I'm trying to bring this up now. I have a countdown clock for the mission.
Next tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2CL repeater.
We're going to be cut off in about a minute and a half, Paul.
Okay, ball goes well. I go to launch schedule. This thing was delayed. Right now it's going off. 6:17 Pacific. The 21st. So 6:17 Pacific. 9:17 Eastern on the 21st.
Sounds to me like you intend to watch that one. What you guys have just heard is technet number 1688. You just heard the base report number 288. I'm not sure, but we probably just had the science and physics report number 15 or something like that. We'll eventually figure out those numbers.